are listening to the Friends Electric Podcast, Episode 1, Apple versus Flash versus HTML5. Recorded May 1st, 2010 with your hosts, Tyler Sticka and Peter Woolley. Good evening and welcome to the inaugural Friends Electric Podcast. I'm your host, Tyler Sticka, and with me is the other host. I'm going in alphabetical order here, Mr. Peter Woolley, a designer developer who I went to school with, which is cool. Know each other a while, and now you are at McAfee, correct?
Indeed, I am.
Very cool. And so we've been talking about doing this podcast for a very long time. I think when was the first time someone brought this up to us? Was it at a Web Visions, or I can't remember exactly when? But this
it was at some conference, probably.
Yeah. This has been brought up. I think people hear us nerd out at tables in public places a lot, I think the natural inclination of a web designer or developer is like, hey, you're doing that for fun. Why not make it public? Here we go. But we're here to talk about something that I think if you're on Twitter or Facebook, something that's definitely been a hot topic among web designers and developers, and that. It's been an issue. This issue of HTML5 versus plugins, etc., has been an issue for a while. But what really started the ball rolling this last week was Steve Jobs. Although I doubt, judging from how curt and short his emails are, that Steve Jobs actually writes these blog posts himself. But he could. But Steve Jobs allegedly writes this blog post on Apple called "Thoughts on Flash," and I guess it could more appropriately be called "I Hate Flash" or "Flash is Totally Stupid and Here's Why." But he basically outlines, why. Peter, maybe you should say like what exactly is Apple saying here? Like, what's the gist of their post?
So I got two things from it. The first thing was that they wanted to tell us that we are never going to see Flash running on the iPhone. Now, there's a couple of places where Jobs mentions that, like, they might have if Adobe was able to show them that it would work on a phone, but he has never seen that, which is an interesting point to make. But in my opinion, it came across as this is a reason why we're never going to do it. And then the other one was to discuss why Apple's approach, which is often seen as closed, and one could argue that's the case, is actually more open than the Adobe Flash model, which I think is actually one of the weirder concepts. And one thing, like, this starts out as a hardware thing for Apple, and it's totally a software thing for Adobe with Flash, but there's actually a number of parallels, which I think we should definitely talk about.
Great, yeah, definitely. What I find interesting is going back to your mobile Flash comment, I have to admit, when I hear that, based on my personal experience, it's been interesting. I'm a big geek, as you know, and I think you share that sentiment. And I have one of these Korean handheld systems, this GP2X Wiz, and it just takes an SD card, but it's got a touch screen on it, and it's a resistive touch screen. It's not capacitive or anything fancy, but it actually is running the latest version of Flash Mobile. I know that Flash has been working with Android and a few other makers, but the actual, like, the version of Flash Mobile that's able to be used on even, like, I think it's the same one Opera uses on the Wii browser and some stuff like that. This is what's typically available to hardware manufacturers. And I put my game Ramps on it just to try, you know, using it. And it's more than just the device or anything like that. It's almost like the events that are firing are pretty unresponsive with regards to touch. I mean, this could be the hardware, of course, but it is. Do you find it as curious as I do? Like I kind of agree with Apple here. If Flash rocks so much on a device, why aren't we seeing it? Another example you might think of is, I don't know if you saw the hands-on with the Juju tablet, that weird quagmire. It used to be the Crunch Pad. Yeah. But that tablet runs Flash, and its big thing is, like, we run Flash and the iPad doesn't. But when you see walkthroughs of it, they even went out of their way to mimic Apple's approach in how it handles YouTube. When you go to a YouTube video, it gives you two play buttons, one with a proprietary H.264 player that's on the Juju, and one that's in Flash. And the reason it does that is because the Juju player plays really smoothly. It's using hardware acceleration, and if you have to do the Flash version, it plays like crap. Hulu and stuff like that stutters on this device. Do you think that falls into Adobe's court? Do you think that the hardware manufacturers are just lazy in how they're implementing it? I mean, why is that? Why aren't we seeing a good version of Flash on these devices?
So there were two things. There's the first one that Jobs mentions in Thoughts on Flash, where it's his fifth point, and he says, fifth, there's touch. And it's that issue with having to rewrite things because touch is definitely not the same as click. Because with click, you have things like dragging, you have a mouse over, where you get these rollover events. You get all these things that you just don't get with touch. I had this before he posted this, I had this conversation because someone was mentioning, I think on Gizmodo, that this might be a reason that Flash doesn't really work. And I got two Flash developers that we actually both went to school with, and they on Buzz, Google Buzz, they decided that that was the appropriate social network to tell me this on. That they said that you wouldn't have to do that, and if you did, it'd be like just a simple recompile or something with the Swift, like that basically everything would work. And I mean, the part is that I don't have these things to test on, so I don't know if that's really not the case. But from my experience, a lot of what you do in Flash and a lot of the kind of, I guess, extra interactivity that makes it quote-unquote better than just your standard HTML, JavaScript, and CSS is that you get these fantastic animations when you're rolling over things, or there's like a UI I know that was, I think you actually posted a link on Twitter that had focused on a UI that you never clicked. You just rolled over things to kind of explore the space, and that just would not work in a touch environment.
Right.
And it's just odd to me that people would argue that it's this tiny thing when I've actually been playing with a bunch of things like JQ Touch, the jQuery extension that you can actually use to make things work better on the iPhone, make really nice apps that work as web apps. It works pretty well. The unfortunate part is that you have to make a different app, really, than if you just have a normal one for normal web browsing with a mouse. So that's, I think, the biggest issue is that there's actually something that people have to do to make their apps run with it. And as far as I know, Adobe hasn't made one that works with these touch events. I've never seen anything coming out in the ActionScript 3 specs that are going to support this touch stuff. My guess is that it's the fact that they just run crappy, like your comment on the Juju stuff. If this whole Google Android 2.2 thing works out, where Flash is actually deployed to a lot of these mobile, Snapdragon 1 gigahertz machines like the Nexus 1, I think then we'll actually get to see if it works. But my guess would be that it's going to be just like everyone's talking about, and it's not going to run very swiftly.
Basically, part of this post, I think, is Apple challenging Adobe. All right. If this is a good experience, if users will seek this out and want it, then show us. Give us a device that has it on it. Show us it being, you know, successfully deployed. And that is interesting because your point about the difference in interactions between sort of PC web design and touch-based design is an apt one because, you know, there's no reason, like 95%, just ask Jason Grigsby, 95% of these apps could probably be deployed in a web fashion through mobile Safari or something. I mean, you look at apps like mobile Gmail, and before that, I know that we were really smitten with how amazing Edit Grid's mobile app was. Dropbox had a terrific one. And yet, as soon as Dropbox's app, as soon as all of these, if Gmail released an official app on the iPhone that was a native app, I would probably download it. And part of that is just that for some reason in Safari, there's absolutely no way to hide the back next, that Safari bar on the bottom, which on a phone is valuable screen real estate, and it annoys the crap out of me. But one of the other reasons, I think, is just that I think the user can feel when something is designed for a touch paradigm, and it does feel like there's a level of abstraction in mobile Safari that isn't there with native apps. I don't know if it's the speed, I don't know if it's that you see the images load in and sort of the skeleton of it is more visible, but I do wonder, I think what people want is I think people want a visually oriented, web-friendly app development platform. Kind of like what Microsoft is giving Windows Phone 7 developers. And now, I'm not a Silverlight developer, and I should disclose it, that I work at Wagner Edstrom, which is our chief client is Microsoft. But it is interesting to see, like, there's almost this weird thing where what Windows Phone 7 is telling developers, it's like, hey, use these web-centric, pre-established tools. And I wonder... I think the potential for successful interactions created with Flash and simply ported to the iPhone is pretty low, which leads me to believe that maybe lazy designer and developers want that. But the reason this is upsetting people is they look at Objective-C and they look at Cocoa and they look at, for a lot of people, myself included, the prospect of investing in a Mac-based development setup, especially when Apple seems to be... kind of putting their OS X development on the wayside, especially with the current WWDC promotions. And they're saying, man, I really wish that there were a way to develop for this that really spoke to my needs as a developer. And so I know for me, their announcement that they would be basically disallowing these services like Flash, but also many of these other, I can't remember any of them off the top of my head. Maybe you can, these platforms for development outside of Xcode and things of that sort. It's really just saying, you know, develop our way or the highway. Now, do you think that Apple's saying, but hey, we've got mobile Safari, you can use HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript? I mean, is that a good compromise? Is that their way of saying, you know, stop complaining about Objective-C and about the iPhone SDK? You've got mobile Safari. That's your playground. Is that good enough for the typical designer?
I think we can all remember that when it came out and they said that the SDK for the iPhone was and the app platform was going to be mobile Safari, and we're all like, that is ridiculous. We have this phone which the browser is not going to open up, and it still hasn't. So mobile Safari still hasn't opened up the APIs. Like we don't have native access to these APIs. We can barely get accelerometer information. The only way we can really get that is based on the orientation of the phone. And as far as I know, the iPad is the only one that actually has orientation events. Like there was that whole argument from Joe Hewitt this week after this post about how doing things in HTML5, you can kind of mimic Flash, but if you're really looking at it as developing for the iPhone, if you compare Cocoa to Cocoa development to web development on and what you can do, it's just silly. So yeah, I think that Jobs would use that argument if people would agree with it. Like, oh yeah, I mean, if you guys think that you can do everything that you need to in mobile Safari, or if you small, you know, bit of standardistas think that, then we don't need Flash. I mean, I think he'd like to say that, and maybe that's just like a free thing that comes along with him hating Flash so much. But when you really get into the nuts and bolts of it, you just can't tell people. I agree. You just can't tell developers that they can only develop things one way. I agree that they're going to have better products when people do that. But like even in my setup, when I just wanted to start playing with this stuff, I had my Dell Mini 9. I finally was able to hack it with a retail copy of Snow Leopard. I was finally able to squeeze on, because I didn't have much space, the actual Xcode install with all the iPhone stuff. And then I was able to play with just the iPhone simulator with some Objective-C. Like, I couldn't even stick it on my phone because I still needed to pay $99. And if anything, I feel like Steve Jobs is saying, like, well, the people that actually care about developing for the iPhone are going to go ahead and pay for that. And if you kind of want to play around with the iPhone stuff, develop on mobile Safari, and then, hey, it'll work on Android too, or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It is interesting because Apple does acknowledge that they have a lot of proprietary products. I think there's actually the sentence, Apple has many proprietary products too. But then they immediately dive into their support of HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript. And there is this odd tension there, there's this dichotomy there, because you have this company. I mean, anyone who's tried to pitch a client on a mobile website can tell you how difficult it is. It still is a little bit alien to the average client. Like, okay, so it's a version of my website in a browser that is optimized for telephone-based interactions. Telephone, geez, I'm gonna use my telegraph and go down to the drugstore and mimeograph some things. No, it's catered for mobile devices, and that sounds alien to them. But if you say iPhone app right now, oh man, it's like, where do I sign? It's like there's such this buzz around it that in some ways I hate the iPhone SDK because it is completely overshadowed all the amazing developments that are happening in good old-fashioned meat and potatoes web design right now. People, a lot of developers and a lot of designers are unaware of all the capabilities they do have in the browser. But at the same token, no company has done more and invested more in furthering HTML5 than Apple, with the possible exception of Google. Like, this is a company. Safari rocks HTML5 and CSS3 and these capabilities, arguably more than Firefox, certainly more than, you know, Internet Explorer. And Chrome is based on their open source browser WebKit. And so It does boggle my mind, and in some ways, you know, I wonder what's the future of that. Like, eventually, does HTML5 become, or does HTML, whatever the next version is, or 40 years down the line, according to how the specs are drafted, but is there eventually, like, a path where Apple might have to switch that position because they find that they're eating their own lunch in a certain respect, or will it always be sort of in that browser ghetto? Like, as long as it's in that sandbox, people are never going to feel like it's truly a part of their device and of their experience.
I think the biggest thing for me for the web development stuff on the iPhone now is the fact that you can tap the bottom of any page, add it to your homepage, and it will do its best to make a nice little icon, take the name of the page, and make it like a little app. I think because that's the way that it started, I think that's the only reason why the iPhone has those capabilities. But as compared to, like, Android right now, which I think when you want to, like, bookmark a site, you can, I think you can get it onto the homepage, but all you can use is the fave icon, so it's like the 16 by 16 icon, which is obviously ugly, especially on the beautiful screens like on the Nexus One. But Apple right now with the iPhone is, I think, doing the best job at making apps feel the most like, or web apps feel the most like real apps. And until we get over this idea that they're separate, I don't think that we're ever going to, people are going to see that ghetto. They're going to go, oh, you have to open up Safari to get to it? That's stupid. But right. If it was something where we could automatically install the, just the little web app icon into the actual, like, on a page in your iPhone apps, or if you could go to the iPhone App Store and actually just, I who knows, maybe you could even pay 99 cents, which would then give you a token, which would then install just a web app, you know, basically a Safari link that installs the web app, and then it just sends that token back and forth so that you can see if someone's actually paid for it, and then we could actually put a pricing model for these simple web apps. I mean, if you really look at it, especially JQ Touch, if you have all the options set correctly, you can just make a quick app. If the person pushes the home button or pushes the plus button and sends it to their home app page, then when they open that thing, it goes full screen. You get a splash page just like the real apps do. You don't get any of the back buttons. You don't get any of anything. Your app really has to be able to handle itself, which can be good and bad for web apps because web apps aren't always that way. But I think that Apple has done the best job, but they need to keep driving it forward, because I know the thing that I hear about, I think Peter Paul Koch, the Quirks Mode fella, he talked about how we can have these quote-unquote HTML5 apps. We can talk up the idea of HTML5 as this, basically this new web. I don't want to say it's the evolution of Web 2.0, but maybe that's what it's starting to be. But
Web 3.0.
Like, Web 3.0. Oh, man, if we start versioning the web further, that's just going to destroy us. But anyway,
yes,
however you want to call it, if we can get it to that place where they feel like real apps, then we're going to need to, or maybe before then, we're going to need to be able to have people get paid for this. Now, I'm not convinced that the way that the App Store works is going forward is the best way to make money. I like in-app purchases, I think, were a good idea. I myself am kind of afraid of them. I don't exactly know why. I kind of like just being able to go to the App Store, see the exact price, and know I'm only going to pay that. But maybe it's just because I haven't gotten used to it, and maybe not a lot of other people have either. But if there could be a way that people could get even a small amount of payment, you know, a 99-cent payment or whatever, for someone to use their web app, I think a lot more people would invest in these web apps, because now you make them, it's almost like you make them either out of love, or you have a main site that requires that you pay for something with, you know, it has a login, and then you, like, you pay for this privilege. I mean, the Remember the Milk app, I know I didn't jump over to Remember the Milk until Todoist just completely failed me, because the iPhone app was like, what, you have to pay for premium? And now that I've come over, it's nice, but it is a little weird that you had to do that. So I could see that if it's a two-step process where you have to use something on the real internet before you can use something on the mobile internet, it might freak people out.
Right. And what you're talking about is actually one of the most positive aspects to this app marketplace economy that's forming as a result of the App Store, but also by extension in the Android marketplace and all these other ones. And it's actually this beautiful thing that I remember being excited about and then disappointed it didn't manifest itself after I read Scott McCloud's Reinventing Comics. And in that book, he talked about a bunch of ways artists would hopefully get reimbursed for their content. And he talked about how in most media, we have this weird separation between the means of earning money and the means of creating content. It's not a one-to-one. It's not, I like what you're doing, here's money. It's usually some sort of advertising-based thing, or we kind of have to like Trojan horse it on people. And it becomes kind of this obscuring factor of what is actually successful. You know, it's like if shows like, I'm going to nerd out again here, but if shows like Firefly were based on a model where the fans paid Joss Whedon or the production company directly, you know, here's the money, and produce the show, give us the show, chances are it would probably still be on the air. But what happens is that it gets filtered through whatever bureaucracies exist to please advertisers and programming managers and stuff like that, and something gets lost. You can see this. I had to rat really hammer on Fox here, but you can see this with the fact that Family Guy got canceled twice.
Yep.
But what saved it were the DVD sales. So obviously that says that if people are able to pay a set fee directly for the content, it'll show that the content is in demand. But if it's put through the wacky Rube Goldberg machine of the advertising model, all of a sudden that value is obscured. And I love the idea of great ideas being given a straightforward price tag. And so you go, hey, I like this idea and I want to use it. Here's 99 cents or here's a dollar. Like, I love that concept. I've wanted the web to be that way for a long time. And I love free stuff as much as all internet users do. I mean, as a Media Center PC owner, I love, you know, having Hulu and things like that on there. But I also pay for Netflix, and there's something there. But you're right that in-app purchases and this iAds stuff they announced with their iPhone 4.0 OS, the sort of HTML5, oddly HTML5-powered rich advertising experiences are interesting, because to me it felt like Apple had struck this really nice balance. But I don't know if it's because free apps are still downloaded more than paid apps are, but we're still kind of, I can see us getting to a place where we're going to sort of run into this ad-infested hole that I think a large amount of the internet is, and it's the reason why things like Adblock exists, plugins like Adblock Plus. But what scares me about it is, here's a platform where we really have no control over that. We can either choose to not download the apps or not. Do you think that this is going to, I mean, is this going to have a negative effect on the overall user experience of applications, or is this going to have a positive effect in that you'll have less intrusive, more relevant ads resulting in cheaper or more free experiences?
I think it really depends on how it's actually implemented. So this week, the guy that made Tweety and the guy that made another app that I hadn't used, I think called Gorange or something to that effect.
Gorange?
They made Texty, and that was curious because this is one of those things where the only way to really pay for it, and it's $2 if you want to pay for the app without the ads. The only way to do that is to just download the app, and then it's an in-app purchase to actually download it. That is peculiar to me. But what's weird is that I realize now that I'm very used to seeing a free or a light or a simple or some sort of basic app that exists for free, you know, for like a trial run, and then you can. You actually have to go and download and pay for a whole separate app if you actually want to buy it. And what I didn't think about was from a developer perspective, if you like store all your information in the iPhone app itself, that can be problematic. And so I should actually be more appreciative of what they're doing in this case, because if I've got Texty, which I've actually switched to using Texty to text with Kara, my wife, back and forth.
Oh yeah, it's a great app. I've been trying to convince my colleagues to take advantage of it so I can save on texts and things.
Yeah, I mean it's great. It's a great idea. It's not the first one, but I think it is as far as I've played with them. It's the best looking app. I know that it's coming from somebody who delivers fantastic things. I mean, we know that Tweety is great, and so in that way, I guess I should be used to the fact that, or I should be used to just buying it and then being able to just upgrade, because then I don't have to I don't have to re-download the app. I don't have to reset anything up. Like it'll just work, and I won't have to do anything extra. But in my head, I've gotten so used to this idea that we have free apps in the App Store and we have paid apps in the App Store, and we have to go back and forth to find them. So I think focusing on that, getting people to accept the in-app purchases, and then putting in ads that are relevant, and I would argue beautiful, inside the Texty stuff, similar to the way that Tweety for the Mac works, you get your ads in line with things. So they just kind of like add themselves to the conversation, but they're obvious, so it's not like you think someone's telling you something that an advertiser is trying to tell you. But instead of it like always being at the bottom, like I think Google has some ads where there's some ad functionality, and even the functionality that they showed in the in the iAds demo during the keynote. It looked good once you got into it, but they still, like, they're sitting down there at the bottom, they're always in the way, and when I keep seeing that, I think you're right. I think that when we get in there and every single ad we have, yay, it's free, but it's also got, like, 10,000 ads in it, or we're seeing ads constantly, we're just going to get frustrated, and somebody is going to want to make an ad block, and because we've accepted the red pill, I guess, that we exist inside of, or I guess it's the blue pill, we exist inside of Steve Jobs' matrix just as happily as can be. So I would ask you, has your current experience with the ads been obtrusive, and do you think that with iAds coming into being that it's going to get worse, or it's going to get better?
You know, I guess what I'm a little worried by is how I want, as laughable as Facebook ads occasionally are, like I think it's funny whenever you see a post on, you know, I'm wearing sunglasses in my Facebook photo, I keep getting sunglasses ads, yep. or I think it's funny that I have taught at Art Institute of Portland, yet I get ads asking if I want to attend the Art Institutes all the time. So it has a lot of misfires, but the other day I was thinking about, what ads have I actually clicked on or been engaged with online in the last, you know, year or 2 years? And the only ones that came to recent memory were Facebook ads. And very recently, in fact, I had just been chatting with a friend of mine about how I was hoping the band Pavement would come to Oregon because I'm not able to see them at the Sasquatch Festival. And That very day, I happened to be clicking around Facebook, and there was an ad on the right-hand side that said, hey, Pavement's coming to Oregon.
Wow.
They're going to be at this venue. Click here. And I did. I clicked the ad, and it gave me the info I needed, and thankfully I ended up securing those tickets. And I didn't realize at the time, because it just seemed so contextual and natural, I didn't even realize, oh, I just clicked an ad. It was like, hey, Pavement. But it was an ad put on by the concert promoters, and that's incredibly relevant. What Jobs appears to be showing is much more ham-fisted, where it's like, hey, we're app A, B, or C. We've been paid by company A to show this banner, you know, that if you click it, it shows what's kind of like this sort of like CD-ROM style or Hollywood movie style page that just has a bunch of random crap or a very simple game, the sort of games you would see on iTunes special features or extras and everything like that. And I don't know, like, it's cool. I guess a standardized approach is good because some of the in-app ads have been truly terrible. I mean, way worse than that, where they're not even thoughtful. They're just like a weird dark gray horizontal strip with like a vomited out text or whatever. And I'm just like, what is this? You just scroll by immediately. It's like Google Ads evil twin or something. And, So it's a positive change, but I guess, you know, these mobile apps, we do so much of our activity on them. It just seems like they have enough information that I was kind of hoping that Apple would go, and the relevancy is plugged into, you know, here's your API hooks to give it some relevance or something like that. And instead it seemed to be more about like, hey, here's the stuff advertisers can put in front of the user's eyeballs, but not, and here's why the user will care beyond, look, it's prettier and it launches a full screen experience or something like that. As a user, I don't feel convinced that, like, okay, great, it's better. And they picked a great example because I actually am interested in Toy Story 3.
Right.
But thinking more broadly, like, think about the ads I see on Hulu. Like, all these car ads and ads for, like, the KFC Double Down, which I can say from experience is not a product you want to pursue. But these are, like, that's the sort of stuff I can see. Like, I'm going to get, like, an Audi ad or something like that. It's going to make me choose which car I want or something like that. And I don't think I'll ever click that stuff. There's only so many Pixar films, you know. I guess it all depends on the advertisers, but the examples Steve showed seem to be these kind of very broad national or international product type things. And what I'm more interested in is less of the, hey, look, Burger King has a new, you know, food for you to try, but more this hyper-local, like, look, a band you like is going to be in town. Click here for tickets. Because I think that's the real promise of online advertising, is being able to say, like, look, here's a product in your backyard, and we've catered this experience to you. And so, to me, it's just like, yeah, great, Apple, you know, you standardize this, you've made it prettier. I'm sure that in and of itself is great, but you're not innovating in the ad space at all. All you're doing is, because I know that he was going on and on about like how awesome it is. Have you ever seen ads like this? But anyone who's seen really big flash ads where you click it and it expands over the experience has seen this thing with videos playing and games and big buttons and stuff. I mean, did it strike you as being like mind-blowing or just kind of like, hey, advertisers, the iPhone is a platform now?
I think the thing that came up was like, well, like he was talking about, you can have things that completely cover an app without having to go to Safari, which apparently some ads just open a link to Safari. I've seen several that have the behavior that he's talking about, so I'm not sure if he just had his facts mixed up there. But he wanted to push that, you know, this, if somebody actually does click on this, it's a great experience, it moves them right through. And I was not shocked. I mean, when he said, oh, it's HTML5, I mean, as a web developer, I guess I kind of know what you can do with that. So when he showed that, oh, there's a little game, it's like, well, yeah, great, it's a little game. That's pretty simple to do. And it's not like what you're talking about, where it's somehow completely relevant. It's like built into the experience of the app. You don't actually know what app the ad itself is running in, at least as far as they've talked about. There's just not a lot of tie-ins. It looks like they're making it prettier, like you said, which is, you know, great, but not super fantastic. It's not going to floor me, and it's certainly not going to make me think, oh, the next app that I'm going to make, I'm going to make it free, and I'm going to put in these iAds. Because then you also have to deal with the whole kind of App Store experience, where he said that in the Q&A after the event, they said, you know, is it going to be as draconian as the App Store? And he said, it won't quite be like that, but that you'll still have to go through some approval process. And we all know that, you know, Apple puts the smackdown on things they don't like. So if your ads aren't what Apple deems appropriate, then you're going to run into lots of problems, whether that's either content or style. I'm not, you know, really sure, but I think it's going to be a problem nonetheless. And overall, I think the initial experience, before they kind of maybe step it up and add in the relevancy, maybe like the way that Google Ads did as they were evolving the Google Ads, I just don't think it's going to be that great.
Right. And Apple doesn't have a history of putting much stock in recommendation engines and things of that sort. Anyone who's used the iTunes recommendations versus even Amazon circa 2001 know that it's pretty awful. But so we've talked a lot about the iPhone and everything, and I'm going to now move us toward the second sort of blasphemous blog post of the week. Although this one wasn't actually a blog post, this was a series of Twitter posts from Joe Hewitt,
right.
Who designers are probably familiar with Joe because he did the Facebook app for the iPhone. It was one of the first like major branded iPhone apps, and with the latest version that came out, I think it was earlier this year, or was it late last year? I can't remember exactly.
I think it was late last year.
Yeah, but it's fantastic. Anyone who's used it knows that it's just it's on my home screen. It's on a lot of people's home screens, I'm sure. It's really an incredibly full-featured Facebook experience. And notably, Joe is also the one who's responsible, or who was responsible, for the web-based mobile Facebook experience. So he's got a lot of skin in this game, so to speak. And he did a series of tweets where he essentially, in response to the Thoughts on Flash post that we just discussed and the resultant aftermath, said that anyone who is voicing a hatred of Flash needs to redirect it to the W3C for, and I'm quoting, their embarrassingly slow pace, which, another quote, forced devs to use a plugin because the standards were so weak. And in these posts, he essentially calls out standardistas as being people who are essentially holding browsers' feet to the fire in a way that's making them refuse to innovate in order to satisfy us with consistency. And he suggests that browser makers need to go, quote, go nuts with non-standard APIs and let the W3C standardize later. Now, these are really strong words. I'm sure we both agree and disagree with some of them to a certain, I don't want to use the word degree again, but I'm going to, degree. Yep. And so I'm wondering, you read this, what's your take on it? Do you think that designers owe Flash and those sort of plugins something, or do you think that these things have been sort of distractions from the web moving forward?
I guess I have to say that I agree with both. So he talked about actually something that I didn't really even know about. He talked about how in the late 90s, the web was really moving. Like when IE came and it usurped Netscape Navigator, it wasn't just because it came free on the operating system. When you bought Windows, you got IE after IE had come out, that's what I always said. It was like, oh, the only reason IE won was because they shipped it for free. But what I think another part of that, and he actually mentioned, was that from 96 to 2000, IE was really moving. They were adding a ton of stuff. Yeah, it was all proprietary, but it was cool. Like, you could see all this new stuff. You're getting all of these, you know, all the special JavaScript stuff, ActiveX, obviously a failure, but a big step forward. It's kind of like Flash, and it came without having to download a plugin. Like, it's pretty cool.
Right.
You could do that. But then we all got fed up with them, and in 2000, we actually had them stop developing because we thought they were taking over things, as Microsoft often does. And I mean, he blames the standards committees for that, as well as the government for all the antitrust stuff. But so I do think that that's a problem. That's a curious thought that I had never actually thought about. And so kind of out of that, Flash, I think, really grew. I know that when I found Flash, I was like, this is amazing. And it runs on the web and it's fast and like 98% of people have it. This is a great thing. I know I was super enthusiastic about it. And it came at the time that I was learning, you know, I was moving away from table-based layouts with just plain HTML and learning this idea of actually separating your content and your style and your behavior with JavaScript. And I can say that I was definitely distracted by Flash. And when I went into Flash, I didn't move to these principles. I didn't see it as, oh, I need to separate these things, or I need to embrace these great ideas. I had ActionScript 2, I had Flash 5, I went nuts. I think the first thing that I made was like an intro for a fake movie that I was never going to make. And then another one I made, it was like a little kind of oversized banner ad that had an alien spacecraft spinning up, sucking up a cow from a field and then flying off. And I was just like flabbergasted with this, and I loved it. And I would show it to people and they would think it was great, and I was like, yeah, and you can put it on the internet, like I can send you a link to it and it works, and you probably already have Flash. So yes, very distracting, but it was painful in those years when IE6 was around. Like, it was basically, you couldn't really do anything with CSS because Netscape didn't support it, and it wasn't until Firefox came along, or, you know, Firebird, and then whatever it was called before, Firebird. Like, as they were working on it, it became super cool. They were introducing these new things. CSS actually worked really well. It worked at a similar level as IE6, and then it started going past that, and I think then that's when I started to get more excited about it and kind of leave behind Flash. I was so curious about Flash as a platform and really what it could do, and I could, you know, I'd always say that, well, in Flash you can rotate images, but when it really comes down to it, like, if you want to rotate an image and you have to load up a plugin, that's just super obnoxious. And so I love limitations, so you just limit the design and say, you know what, I'm not going to have rotated images, or I'm going to do it on the server side or something, so you can limit yourself that way. And so I think as things started picking back up because of Mozilla, and I'd say that because people started caring about standards, then the W3C started picking up its pace as well. Now, we all know that it's god-awfully slow, and it's probably never going to be fast, and Joe Hewitt is right. I think we need to move forward on stuff, and let them make them standard later. But for the stuff that they're really designing well, like CSS isn't fantastic, but CSS 3, there's a lot of stuff in there that we've already started using that's great. I think the CSS 3 layout system is going to be great, but I think it's going to take a ton of work. And as far as I know, nobody's actually put the time in on the browser vendor side. But I think that there's a lot of movement there, and if we embrace both, we say, okay, for the big things and for even for the exciting things, let's do some stuff with the W3C. Let's get all the browser vendors together. Let's let them work on stuff. But then, you know, if somebody gets a crazy hair and the browsers or the W3C doesn't really want to hear it, the browsers can just implement it. I mean, web workers, I think, are an interesting case. They kind of started out in the HTML5 spec. As far as I know, they're not in the HTML5 spec anymore, but I'm very curious. Like, having asynchronous tasks in JavaScript that don't need to contact the server, but you can basically just spawn new threads, so you can have, like, non-UI blocking number crunching. Like, you can put ray tracers inside of your browser, and and that got, you know, that got pulled from the spec because people realize, or from HTML5, because people realize you're not going to get everybody to do that. But we've got it in, what do we have it? We have it in Chrome and, well, we have it in WebKit, so we've got it in Chrome and Safari. Firefox has them, and who knows if I will ever have them, but, you know, I guess in their cases, that's their loss. But, you know, if you want to start using it and you're willing to limit the groups that you're, the audience that you're reaching out to, you can do those things. So I guess I just have to agree a lot with what Joe Hewitt is saying, but then he kind of stops and says that because the standards body moves so slow, it's a waste of time. We shouldn't be doing this. We shouldn't wait for them. But in a lot of those cases, there's features that we are only going to see in a couple of browsers if we don't actually let the standards body do what they're meant to do.
Absolutely. And part of this is that I feel like what Joe Hewitt is saying is, I don't know what the word is, I want to say prophetic, except that he's not seeing the future, he's kind of seeing the present. Because what he's talking about and what you're talking about is browsers forging ahead with non-standardized APIs and basically attempting to innovate. And I know it's probably not, you know, I think it's healthy that they're not going like totally all out ActiveX with it, but to implement a partially finished draft spec or to implement features like you're talking about that have been completely eliminated with a spec, that is implementing a non-standard API for the sake of innovation and for the sake of enabling your web designers. Like, you know, it may not, like I said, be ActiveX, but it is, you know, in the strictest sense, that's what they're doing. And we've seen this before, too, in the past. I mean, I know this is pre-IE6, but I mentioned in a blog post I wrote last night that CSS grew out of a proprietary, I shouldn't say proprietary, but there was a web browser named Argo that had a style sheet specification called SSP, which I'm blanking on what that stood. Oh, that stood for a stream-based style sheet proposal. But enough people liked it that it was combined with a couple other ideas, but that grew into CSS and eventually became a standard. Same thing with JavaScript. JavaScript started out as LiveScript, of course, in Netscape, and actually was a proprietary technology of Netscape for a long time. That's why IE's implementation of JavaScript was called JScript for so long. Right. They couldn't call it JavaScript because that was Netscape's trademark until Netscape submitted it for ECMA approval. And that's why if you're a real stickler, you know that technically the JavaScript standard is actually ECMAScript.
ECMAScript 262.
And so, yeah, and so this is kind of a natural progression, right? I mean, browsers don't have any way to render video, so plugins like Flash and later Silverlight and things of that sort come in to fill in the gaps. They give us this necessary means to push forward in spite of the bureaucracy that's necessary from... I mean, you're talking about a standards-defining organization. This is not the type of activity that's meant to move quickly. I mean, if you ask any sort of like community involvement organization or something like that, it is getting a consensus of dozens of individuals, passionate individuals, some of which are there to steer the future of their business, is getting a consensus between them as quick as implementing the solution. I'm guessing most of them will say no. And so it's natural, I think, for these companies to forge ahead, and I think it's a good thing. And so what Flash showed us, and more importantly, what implementations of Flash showed us, like YouTube, obviously, is the natural example, showed us is that video is the new canonical technology on the web. Users expect to be able to watch video on the internet. It's now one of those things, along with viewing images and text and downloading files, etc., that users say that's what the internet is for. And when that happens, that's your cue. Just like CSS defined that HTML should be able to be designed for different media types, and JavaScript said that HTML should be capable of more complex interactions, these plugins are going, hey, look, we should really be supporting video, and the browser makers eventually have to come to a consensus because that's what all the users are doing, and it kind of, I don't want to say forces their hand because I'm sure that the standards bodies aren't like resisting the idea of video because it's so obvious, but basically gives them the need, the necessity to acknowledge that this is a critical part of the web experience now. And so I think that there's always going to be that leapfrogging of standards compliance and proprietary technology simply because great ideas can't wait. I think this links back to what we're talking about with the App Store. It's like certain applications are not yet possible. Many are, but certain ones aren't possible in HTML5, and there's no reason on principle that someone should gimp their idea or wait an excruciating long amount of time when there's some technology that's fairly available that's there, because the audience will find the product if the technology to do so is above a certain level of ubiquity. And I think plugins like Flash, you know, like it or not, are still kind of up there. But I think any designer or developer that wants to make an experience is going to want it to reach the largest amount of people, you know, that it can. So Flash devotees or plugin devotees, etc., are probably going to tout these statistics. Like, okay, we talk about accessibility, but I think it's something like 98% of everyone can view Flash, and I think it's surprising, like something like 60% of people can view Silverlight, which is crazy for such a short amount of time. You know, so isn't this a red herring? But I say no, because there's only going to be more of these mobile devices, and until Flash proves, and until maybe Windows Phone 7 series proves that these things, these proprietary technologies are going to move along with it, it's foolish for a designer to assume. And so we're going to want to pick that lowest common denominator of technology to get our experience across, because that ensures the largest audience. And so I'm thinking this idea of turning your distaste to the W3C, I think that that's probably a little bombastic, although Twitter's great for bombastic comments.
True.
I think what it really should be is, you know, use these plugins as tools in your toolbox. And like any tool, when it becomes worn out and is starting to look unnecessary or convoluted or obtuse or just not the most elegant solution, you know, put it aside until you have use for it again and embrace these other technologies. I mean, we're talking web programming here. If you go up to most computer science majors and tell them that you're a programmer who does HTML or basic ActionScript, like ActionScript 2 style stuff, they're probably going to laugh at you, because the learning curve between these technologies is fairly low in comparison to a lot of more, I guess, compiled languages. So to me, we should all have the open mind to kind of do what's best for our user base. And I think for most users, that means crafting a canonical experience with whatever technology will get the job done most swiftly. I mean, I think that's just common sense.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think the lowest common denominator mentality, I know that Joe Hewitt was talking against that. He was saying, you know, you should be able to push things for your audience. But when the rubber meets the road, there's always going to be a problem. Like, you can develop with Cocoa, and guess what? You're only going to work on iPhones. That's just the way that it's going to be. So the lowest common denominator, I would agree, you have to evaluate. In some cases, it's bad. If you're trying to talk to a very technical, forward-thinking, very iPhone-based group of people, you know, you can take advantage of those things, and you know that you're going to reach those people. But if you actually do want to build an app for your already existing mobile site, like with Facebook, they need a mobile site, because some people are viewing it on something that is not capable. You know, it's not Android. I think there's a Facebook Android app. I hear it's not as good as the iPhone app, but that's another problem. But for those people that aren't on Android or aren't on any device that has a native app for it, you can log in through the browser, and for the most part, it's probably going to work. And I think that it's not as fantastic, but it reaches people that they would not be able to reach, and I'm sure those people are appreciative of the fact that they actually made it.
Right.
I think a good example a while ago, Jeffrey Zeldman posted a link to Zing Charts, and they've now added you can either output your the chart that you create as a Flash chart or as a Canvas chart using the HTML5 Canvas tag. And I think for a lot of people moving forward, that's a great way to do it. You know, build both. It actually doesn't take that long to port over. I'm not sure if they have a blog post, but I'd be curious to read if they talk about how long the port took. But, you know, why not embrace both? You're going to work in Flash-based things, and you're going to work in places where HTML5 works. And I think I would say even now, a lot of the stuff that we do in Flash, video is a good example, we can now start doing in HTML5 even better than we could in Flash. I think having access to these things in native JavaScript, it exists already in the browser. There's a lot of behavior that you can modify that is a lot harder to do in Flash, or you have to wait for a new Flash player to come out for you to be able to do it. I think that we can start embracing it. And yeah, it's annoying we have to build two things, so it's kind of reminiscent of like building a Netscape site and building an IE site in the 90s, but we're moving, and I think we can all agree that for a lot of these, I don't want to say basic, more basic graphic interactions, so like being able to dynamically draw line charts and do that thing where you can rotate image. Like, you can rotate images now in HTML5 using the Canvas tag, and it's swift, it works in a lot of places, and you don't have to use Flash. I just think that by embracing these things and being willing to let Flash go when it does eventually die, and I will stand by my word and say that it will die. I don't know if it'll be 2012 or 2015 or later, but I think that for the most part, we're going to be able to get a lot of value out of HTML5, and you know, Flash may continue to exist, but our lowest common denominator might even get bigger by taking advantage of both of those things.
Sure, and really what we're talking about is just some of the basic tenets of progressive enhancement, right? It's this idea of having that common denominator, but I don't think what either of us is saying is, hey, get rid of any technology that's going to make your thing cooler, you know, in favor of catering to that lowest common denominator. What we're saying is make the basic experience work for the largest amount of people, and then this might not be the right word, but then reward those that are that have the extra capabilities. The Facebook app is not the typical, you know, idea of progressive enhancement, but it follows a similar principle in that if the idea really was to say, okay, no, I'm not bending to your web technologies, I'm going solely with Coco, then the mobile web experience should just be a button that says click here to download in whatever your app store is.
Right.
But it's clearly not, because Facebook values that audience and wants to meet them wherever they are. I think one of the most powerful functions of the web is that more than anything else, we can meet the user wherever they are now and to have a conversation with them at that level. And I think that's really powerful, and it's something that's a little too valuable to just dismiss simply because you don't like writing things twice or you don't like, you know, and I think that tinkerers have less of a problem with this. Not that I'm saying, I'm sure Joe Hewitt seems like an awesome guy who would probably love to tinker with new technology. That's probably why he's so mad at browsers for having less options than a native SDK does and stuff. So
right.
I'm not in any way trying to say that he isn't like this. But I think a lot of tinkerers like you and I actually love this idea of progressive enhancement. We love that we have to, okay, so if they have no font capability, they're going to see Verdana in this headline. But if they support Font Face, they're going to see this. And if they don't have Font Face, but they have Flash, they're going to see this. I get excited by those sort of fallbacks and everything like that, and knowing, you know, whatever this user situation, they're going to get an awesome experience because I thought through the limitations and the best way to handle them and acknowledge them. And I think that as more browsers progress, and I'm really excited to see IE9's HTML5 and CSS3 support. I wished it was like one version later that they'd leapfrog a little bit more, but I am excited to see their commitment to it at the very least, seeing them throw their hat into the ring, so to speak. And and I'm very happy with the way WebKit's progressing and the way Firefox is. I'm overjoyed every time I can drag a file into Gmail now to attach it. And I'm starting to feel like, you know, we're not in this Netscape and IE world anymore. I mean, I know that there are differences between the browsers, but there's so many more tools available to us now. We no longer are in this world of click here for this experience and this one. You know, we're in this world of, you know, having like a jQuery.features utility so we can check for browser-specific features and switch stuff out. I mean, we are nowhere near perfect yet, and I think that we need to look at these plugins and these proprietary systems like the iPhone for inspiration on where the basic web technology should go. But there has never been, in my humble opinion, a better time to be a web designer or developer. I mean, I'm working on an app right now. It's the first one I've done that's in HTML5 and CSS3. And little things like just not having to use extra divs with background images for rounded corners feel like revelations. And maybe that's a mark against web design, that something that simple is a revelation. But the fact is that we're able to concentrate a lot more right now on the experience than we ever have before. And I think it's a beautiful thing. So I think we shouldn't be, I mean, I'd love to hear your opinion. I think we should be embracing both of these things in tandem so long as they continue to acknowledge each other and continue to have these debates. I think as long as they're yelling at each other from across the aisle this intensely, things are probably pretty healthy, because that means that they're both, my girlfriend often says, the opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference, because hate comes with the same sort of passion and fervor and intention that love does, just from a different emotional center. And I kind of see that is what we're seeing here. Like, the fact that these different camps are so, like, livid with each other and want to occupy the same space is a good thing, because it means they ultimately have similar innovative goals in mind, and that means nothing but good things for the web.
Yeah, I would definitely have to agree with, I think, most everything that you said. I mean, I do agree, especially now, working in a more, how do I want to put it nicely, a more computer scientist-y environment over at McAfee. It's interesting to see, you know, the tenets, the computer science tenets that we definitely did not learn at our time at the Art Institute. But it's also curious to see how a lot of people feel that the web is still very much in its infancy. I mean, I think as long as we've known each other, we've always said this moment right now is the best time to be a web designer or a web developer. And it's because we are, you know, we're making giant strides. But not only are we stuck with sometimes having to do things twice or having to worry a ton about all these browser limitations, we're also given the freedom to innovate in a way that people never have. So the idea of, you know, write once, develop or deploy anywhere is a little tough to swallow now that we're, you know, making the move to mobile. So sometimes we have to, you know, develop twice, deploy anywhere. But we still get to say that for the most part, if we're paying attention to these, to the capabilities of the browsers, and we're writing these fallbacks, we can get an experience that works for a huge number of people, and people can access the stuff that we're making in ways that they never have before. I mean, what are we? We're still at 15 years ago, most people still weren't on this kind of stuff. Like, we can still say that we're, you know, we're making the web something into, it's still new, it's still exciting, we're still continually improving it. And yeah, our development tools certainly aren't up to par as some of our desktop related brethren, but we're still able to constantly improve. And when we improve, they're not small things. We're not playing catch up with these tools. It might look like that to some people, but when we make these improvements, we're making it on a global scale that, I mean, on a cross-platform level that we just never were before. So I'd have to agree, we're in it at the best time. And I think that this discussion and us constantly fighting back and forth about what are the best tools and what's the best way to do things is just going to make things better.
Absolutely. What a rosy note to end that discussion on. I love it. It's like we love everyone. No, I mean, I think both of us would regard ourselves as probably falling more on the standardista side of the table in most
Definitely.
Cases. I love, you know, I think we're both of the school of we find quantum physics interesting, but give us the Einstein's unified theories any day of the week because they just feel more coherent. And yeah. Part of that is that. Part of it is wanting that warm fuzzy, that idea of, great, this is, you know, with a capital T and W, the way to do these things. And you know, plugins muddy those waters. But, I mean, I just get excited whenever there's a new capability, whenever there's something that we couldn't do before. And
yep.
I think it's a beautiful thing. All right, well, I want to thank my co-host, Peter Woolley, again, a designer developer at McAfee. Peter, where can people track you down if they want to hear more of your wisdom?
Well, I'm quite active on the Twitter. That's just Peter Woolley, one word, W-O-O-L-E-Y. And you can also find me at peterwoolley.com.
I'm also on Twitter, username Tyler Sticca, all one word, and you can find my work and my blog at tylersticca.com. To find this episode again or future episodes of the Friends Electric podcast, point your browser or mobile device or whatever you might be using to friendselectric.com. Thanks for listening.